Hi, everyone, and welcome to Rewatchable number 346. Today, we are going to talk about The Matrix 3 Revolutions. My name is Karen, and I'm joined by Brittany, Kendra, and Natalie. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hi.
As usual, if you would like to get into contact with us, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter or Instagram at re_watchable. You can also join our Facebook group, Rewatchables Rewinders. And if you're still a little confused about our move over to Subjectify Media, then you can listen to Not About the Weather podcast episode number 37, which has a complete explanation of everything going on with that. Now, today, with the third movie, we've got a little bit of a mix of super fans and newbies. So just to remind everybody, we're going to go through fun facts so that you can get used to our voices, and we'll let you guys know if we've seen this movie before, how many times we've seen it, if we regret seeing it. So I don't know if we have a theme for today, if anybody has any grand ideas. Otherwise, we'll just wing it like we usually do. But Brittany, why don't you start us off here?
I'm going to pick the worst topic for Natalie of all time because
I knew you were going to do this. Go ahead.
All right. So today is Spotify Wrapped Day.
There you go.
Yeah. Everyone is excited about except Natalie. I actually really don't care. I'm more mortified by what the Spotify Wrapped revealed. However, before we get there, I'm Brittany. I'm a newbie. Never seen this movie before. I don't think I've even seen a clip from this movie before. Maybe like the final rain scene. They're all blurring together at this point. However, so my Spotify Wrapped came in this morning, and 2021 was a very busy and stressful year at work and in life. And so I listened to Spotify pretty much nonstop, as it informed me. I think it was like 27,000 minutes or something like that. But my fun fact that came out of all of this is that I was 1 hour shy, just 1 hour shy of having spent three entire days in 2021 listening to The Killers. And it makes me sad. Could have had three straight days, but
you could listen today. And I just don't like that it comes out on December 1. Like, we need a bit more time to rack up the true years worth, you know. Do they start counting for next year from December 1, or do they just kill December entirely because they're like,
you know, that's a great question.
Skewed by Christmas music.
Because the rest of my top five are all Yuri on Ice songs. And so I'm assuming that it had to kick off in at least some of December, because once I watched it on, like, I think it was December 10th or so, I didn't stop listening to it, but I listened to it the entire year. So actually,
I didn't know that the theme songs were on Spotify for Yuri.
They are. There is also the song that takes place at the banquet. The album cover for that on Spotify has Victor's like bare butt on it. And so listening to it, like, I don't know, but like, if that is on like my lock screen of my phone or on the display of my car, it's a little much. So it's sort of, that was a choice that Spotify allowed. But yeah, I was not surprised with my results, but a little disturbed by how much I listened to The Killers. But I would like to personally thank them for getting me through the year, which apparently they did.
That's good. Good to know. What about you, Kendra? If I had to pick a top artist for you, I think I know which it would be.
You can guess. Who do you think?
It's got to be Taylor, right?
It's got to be Taylor. I am proud again this year to be in the top 1% of Taylor Swift listeners on Spotify.
Oh my gosh. Wait, I'm going to interrupt only because I didn't even know that this number could exist, but I was in the top 0.05% of The Killers listeners.
And I was really, like, that's like, really high.
I was like, I didn't think you could, like, they broke it down that far. I'm like, there's
that's
an extra
really
zero
high
in there. So I'm sorry. Continue.
No. I was upset. I was shooting for higher this year, but I don't know. They don't count the CDs
and the YouTube, like if only Spotify knew how much time I did spend listening to Taylor Swift.
That's true.
It would be much higher. I think it was like 4,000 minutes. But weirdly, my top song was Driver's License by Olivia Rodrigo, which I thought calling bullshit on that, to be honest. I don't believe it. So that's my Spotify Wrapped. In terms of Matrix, I've seen this one once. Same with all the other ones about a couple months ago. And I like this one so much more than the last one.
Okay.
And it might be tied for my favorite with the first, honestly.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
The hottest of takes, really.
There is no judgment here. We are all friends. I don't even know how to recover from that. But okay. Natalie, what about you? Do you have a Spotify Wrapped fun fact?
Yeah, it's that I hate Spotify Wrapped. Hang on a second. Yeah. I want to go first of all, I'll get into that in 1 second. So I'm Natalie. I am not a Matrix newbie, but I can't remember seeing this movie in the cinema, so it's possible that I didn't see it. However, I don't disagree with Kendra. I actually liked it. We'll get into it, but it was interesting. I think this was a tightly made movie. I just don't know if it was particularly interesting. I don't know. Anyway, I don't know if people don't like it because they don't like the endgame plots that happened or if they had issues with like how it was made. But I 100% understand the endgame plots that happened. I just don't understand how they're coming back for a sequel. But I don't dislike this movie. I actually think it was really tight and interesting in certain ways. Spotify Wrapped, every year it shames me. Not because, I'm so embarrassed that I listened to Yuri on Ice for however long. It just shows me how much I don't listen to music at all because it's not as low as it was last year. Last year it was 466 minutes for the whole year. And this year it was 1,466 minutes. And most of that was podcasts, not music. So. Yeah, it just basically makes me resentful and get angry about the fact that, like, people make such a big deal of it, out of it, and the fact that I don't listen to music or I used to be really interested in music and now I just don't care. And, like, yeah, I definitely never listen to music while doing things, ever, because I find it distracting or I definitely don't listen to music while writing, ever. I don't listen to music while just lying around bed. I don't listen to music while I sometimes listen to music while cleaning, but usually I can't be bothered putting it on. I also will often put on the radio and just like let whatever takes me take me as opposed to making a choice. I don't make playlists to go on rotation. I don't have a lot of patience to sit through and listen to new music. But my top artist was also Taylor because of the new listening through to the new records when they came out. So. Like that was like purposeful listening. Like I'm going to sit down and listen and see what happened as opposed to like in the background. I also don't drive, so I don't have car music. When I walk, I could put on music, but I don't really bother. And in recent months, I try to listen to podcasts when I am walking because I'm more interested in people speaking than I am in them singing at the moment. So I just get really aggressively angry at how much it shows me that I don't like music anymore.
I'm just also sad that I dethroned Tim Minchin this year. He was such a staple for so many years since the Groundhog Day cast recording came out because he's like given the credit of it on some of the songs that I listen to a lot. And so like he's always one of my top artists. So sorry, Tim.
Maybe next year you'll get him.
Maybe next year he'll come back.
And every year I'm like, oh, I should really make an effort to like, and I pay for Spotify Premium, by the way. Like I don't just have regular Spotify. I pay for Spotify, though I have a family plan. I have like a couple of friends who share it. And yeah, so it just every year people are like, oh, this much. And I'm like, I'm not showing you mine because people will laugh at me. So yeah. And we had this conversation this morning and I was, oh, my morning.
Yeah, well, because because I woke up and I was just like, it's Christmas. I like bombarded a group chat with Natalie in it. With the
Spotify but it wasn't wrap. Just you. I happened in other group. It happened in my British group chat as well. Like I was just like, I'm a Spotify wrapped Grinch in a big way.
Yes, but as soon as you did that, I was like, I know what my fun fact is.
I know.
I was sitting on it for 12 hours.
We live to torture each other.
It's fine. It's a good suggestion for a theme. I can roll
it. Is because I did not have a fun fact and I was panicking. So I'm really grateful for this. I pulled up my Spotify. I don't listen to a lot of Spotify either. I'm also kind of not a big music listener, I think, because when I write, I can't listen to anything with words in it, usually, unless it's like the Hamilton soundtrack. That one I can write to. But usually I pull up like instrumental stuff, like creepy gothic music for horror writers or something like that. And I usually do that on YouTube. But I did pull up my top songs for 2021. And the top one is Into the Unknown from Frozen 2. But the Panic at the Disco version, which is
so random,
beautiful, and one of the greatest songs ever created. So I'm not mad about that at all.
You know, you can get those long themed sounds on Spotify.
Yes, I just haven't found a ton that I've liked.
Yeah, I don't. YouTube. I usually in the last month, I've definitely used it more because I've been listening to films to be buried with on Spotify. But now I'm going to stop listening to films to be buried with on Spotify, and I'm going to listen to it within the Patreon app because now I'm a patron of the podcast, and they have a longer uncut version there. So goodbye, Spotify, to be honest.
Maybe next year mine will be better. I don't know.
I'm always like, I've got to make an effort. I've got to really try. Maybe I'd be happy because I like singing music. I like watching things with music, like, you know, musicals and like anything with music. I love technically, and I love songs and singing. I just don't fucking listen to music. Part of it's choice. It's like Netflix. I don't like to choose. Like I can't be bothered, and it kind of takes away from the flow. And then part of it's also like I don't do it well. If I like have it on in the background, I'm like, oh, I missed the good bit, and I like put it back, and it's like I kind of listen to it on purpose, which I think is why I like musicals or musical films. It's because I'm listening to it on purpose. Like I'm not meant to be concentrating on anything else.
Yeah. My problem is I put my music on my phone and I listen to it there, and then I'll just listen to the same album like for 8 hours straight.
Do you not have Spotify on your phone?
I do. It's just, I don't know. I have it loaded onto my phone. It's where I go to it. I think I'm just stubborn and stuck in my ways, and that's how I've always done it.
I don't have Apple Music. I don't buy, like, if I buy something, I buy a physical CD. I don't like buy digital things. I either listen to it when it comes to Spotify, or I buy a physical record, like album or CD if I really want it, like the Harry Styles album. Yeah, I don't know. There we go.
There we go. In terms of The Matrix, I guess I'm the superest of the super fans here today. I definitely remember seeing this movie before. I remember absolutely hating it with every fiber of my being, like, ruined the entire trilogy for me, hated it. Let's find out.
Is this just because of the deaths, or is it like,
yes, you thought it was a bad 100% thing because of the deaths? Let's find out if that changed, but you guys are gonna have to stick around. I'm not telling you, I'm keeping it okay. Secret.
Yeah.
All so right. A recap today is pretty succinct. In The Matrix Revolutions, everyone's fighting to save Zion in very different ways, except for Smith. He's trying to kill everyone and everything. And that's the whole movie.
It is the whole movie, but it's tight. I feel like it's actually very focused. Like it's we pick up where we left off in the last episode, last movie. Nebuchadnezzar's dead and they pick up the crew and we're right in it. We're still in the middle of the attack on Zion and we go right back into it.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely feels like a two-parter kind of thing. And I think it works for these two movies together like this. And maybe because of that reason, this is actually the first movie that doesn't open on a huge action sequence. We open aboard the Mjolnir, where Niobe's ship is missing and Neo and Human Smith are unconscious with their ladies by their sides. Although I don't think that was his lady. I think that was just the lady doctor, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's not a straight woman.
Fair enough.
His lady that is attending to him.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, for sure. So in terms of openings, and I guess in terms of going from one movie to the next, what did you guys think of this? Did you like the quieter opening? Brittany, what about you?
Yeah. So when the movie opened, I was like, oh, this is nice. I'm in it. I have to listen to them. Also, one thing though, whiplash with the volume button for this movie, because it is like I had to have the opening on so loud because I could not hear them.
I agree.
And then all of a sudden a battle, I thought my apartment walls were going to come down. I was like, oh my God. But yeah, I loved the quieter opening. I thought we were like getting ready to settle into the story. Not so much a recap. It was very reliant on, listen, this is not a movie for people who are just showing up to the movies. We're jumping right in the middle of it. And I appreciated that, having watched the other two movies, to not be like catered to a fresh audience. Like this is clearly
new exposition, clunky,
right?
Like,
So I thought that opening was a great contrast to the other two. And then, you know, plenty of action later. So it was nice to start out a little quieter.
The volume thing, I wonder, I mean, they should have remixed it for home video, but this film, apparently, Matrix Revolutions, was the first film ever shown in conjunction in normal cinema and IMAX release. It was the first movie ever shown at regular and IMAX at the same time. So it was like maybe something about the sound design was cut for IMAX and they never fixed it. But I don't know.
I felt I was in an IMAX theater at some parts because I was like, oh my God.
Definitely, I had that issue with the volume too. So, yeah.
Kendra, what about you? Because considering, you know, this is up for one of your favorite movies out of the three, I feel like the opening here is a lot more focused on the characters, and the entire movie kind of carries on that way that, yeah, there's still action sequences, but they're not quite front and center as the other movies have been. And this opening sort of sets the tone for that.
Yeah, I like that too. And I can see, as like a huge fan of this series who was seeing it in the theater for the first time, like being a little taken aback by the very different start. But coming into it now, yeah, I like the more focus on the characters. And I feel like the fact that there are less action sequences in this movie as opposed to the second one, which had like 18, 25 minute long action sequences, like it helps that like the entire last half of the movie is an action sequence, and it helps that one feel like warranted and helps it feel more exciting than if like the whole front half had been peppered with action. So I think it was a good choice.
Yeah. And Natalie, I know that you tend to go for the character driven moments and everything, so I'm sure you appreciate it.
I do. And I both was like, I really like how much time we're spending with like Z and Chara, or like the kid and the other general and like all of that. But then I was like, they've cut away from Neo for a long time.
I noticed
like
that
a
too.
Long time. Like they don't cut back and forth. They're not like a little bit here and back to Neo and a little bit here, back to Neo. There was something about the confidence in cutting away from Neo for that long, which makes me think that the filmmakers care a lot more about their own characters and world building than maybe like the casual audience does. Like, I feel like they cut away from Neo too much for a casual audience. Well, not so much a casual audience, because again, like it's not like a film you'd go into not having seen the others, but like the filmmakers seem to have a lot of faith in the fact that everyone will follow them along with these side characters who we haven't really met that well before. like they commit to like following those other tracks away from Neo. I'd be actually really curious to see like a minute count of how much screen time Keanu had in this movie compared to the other ones, like actually minutes on screen versus the length of the film. But I definitely didn't dislike the quiet opening. I definitely liked the kind of talky structure, I guess. Like, I didn't dislike that element of it. I think, again, like some of the action scenes with the robot squids later, it felt a bit drawn out to me, but it is necessary, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree with you about them caring a lot about the people of Zion, maybe a little bit more than the audience does, but I have some feelings on that we'll get to later during the bigger fight sequence.
I feel like they care more than the audience does, but I like them for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it makes me feel fondly of the Wachowskis for caring that much about their little guys. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. But speaking of Neo, so basically Neo is unconscious in the real world. He's not jacked in, but he's stuck at the train station, which is a world between this world and the machine world. And we learn that the train man works for the Merovingian and he smuggles programs in and out of the Matrix. And we meet a program family from the machine world who have a daughter together and they love her, but she has no purpose. So they need to smuggle her into the Matrix. And this is sort of a whole new element.
No, I think it was the other way around, but I got really confused by this.
Did you think they were smuggling her into the machine world?
Well, that's the thing. I think they were smuggling her out of the Matrix because in the Matrix is where they exist as people, right? In the Matrix.
They were taking her to the Oracle, though.
I know, but that made me go, like, what is the Oracle not in the Matrix? Because this doesn't make any fucking sense. Trust me, like, I don't understand how in the machine world they could exist as sentient beings because they are not. They are programs. I thought they were taking her out of the Matrix, but to some like backstage server, basically. And I'm like, I thought the Oracle's house was in the live Matrix. Like, this doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. Maybe they were smuggling her into the Matrix, but into the Matrix is where she would be able to be detected. It's very confusing. I have a lot of things being like, hang on, where is this? Leo was like, the train's kind of like the USB cord. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. But which direction are they going? Are they going to like an offline server? Like, I don't really understand what's happening here. Because the Merovingian
is it possible that they exist as programs in the machine world and just like, and still somehow created this other program between the two of them? And now they're in, I don't know.
Like, they are sentient married people. Those kind of people in the Matrix. Those kind of people exist in the Matrix. It doesn't.
But I think that's the point, is that the machines aren't what we thought they were. Like, the machines are capable of personhood. This version of love that we never would have thought they would be. And I think that is the point. And 100%. Like, the machines have their own organization and they, right now, they need structure and they need everything to have a purpose. And this Sati doesn't have that. So they've made a deal to get her into the Matrix where the Oracle's going to take care of her.
I don't know. I felt like they were getting her out, but it doesn't make a ton of sense either way. Anyway, you're right. The point is, here are some machines in love, and it makes Neo have a thought.
Yes. I guess my main question here, in the beginning at least, is just like, they've introduced another element to the Matrix and it's not like the Matrix, but this world that the Wachowskis have created. Here's another new element, kind of late in the game, third movie and everything. Did you like seeing this as like, oh, there's still something new to discover? Or is it sort of, does it feel like it's been shooed in to be convenient for what they've decided to tell in this third movie?
Neither for me. It didn't feel like it was it didn't feel like it was shoehorned, and it didn't feel new. It felt like an obvious thing that we would meant to be growing on the whole time. For me, like from day one in the Matrix series, I'm like, okay, personhood is like way more complicated than what you're thinking. Like, you're being a purist about this. The whole premise of the first movie is like, the whole time the characters Morpheus and Neo are like, nothing about this world is real. And I'm like, yes, it is, because you experienced it. Your brain, like, yes, all of the feelings that you had were real, and other people there were real. And then in the second movie, we got a little bit of that in terms of like, well, it's also real for like programs going independent and having sentience. So they, you know, it's the big question of like, when does AI become sentient personhood with rights and stuff like that, and like with human rights, with human emotions, with, you know, a self-existence. And I felt like that was there from day one, so it didn't feel shoehorned in to me, and it didn't feel new either. It felt inevitable.
Okay, that's good. Brittany, what about you, since I know this movie was, maybe you weren't the biggest fan of it.
If we had stuck with this plot line the whole time and like didn't have to return to Smith, who like, I still, all of a sudden I was just like into it. And then all like, we just switched back to him and I'm like, why are you still here? I think I would have liked it more. I think this is an interesting topic, especially because even as we started having this conversation, we couldn't figure out what was going on. And I think that
I just looked it up, and I do think she was being smuggled into the Matrix, but I don't think they made that clear. I mean, yes, you see her at the Oracles later, but they didn't really explain how it's possible for those people to be sentient people who had a daughter outside of the Matrix. Like, did they not exist in bodies until they got into that train station? Were they just like vibing in the,
that was my assumption.
I really don't know.
Yeah. It was confusing, though. I will definitely give you that. But Sati was very cute, and I liked her family a lot, and I liked their conversation, the conversation between the family and Neo, especially when it came to love and what love means, you know, it being a word, but it also being a lot more than that, and the connotations that have with it. And that sort of carries on throughout, we'll get to. But we sort of transition from the train station to the Oracle, where Sati is being sent without her family.
Before we do, mm-hmm. I would just like to say that Keanu in the train station looks very handsome.
He does. He does.
He looked very nice there. And it was my favorite look on him in the whole series, the whole three series. He looks the best in that white train station.
Yeah. I have to say I'm excited for long-haired Keanu in the fourth one. Very, very into that.
Everything that was released this week from Entertainment Weekly was just hit after hit. They look fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. We'll talk about that at the end, because obviously this movie has a few, like, you know, it's sort of, what are they going to do in movie four, given the end of this and his, you know, Christ-like sacrifice and, you know, Trinity being dead and all of that. So it's going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess fortunately for the look, Keanu, Neo, is stuck in the train station for a little while longer, because while Sati gets to go into the Matrix, the train man does not allow him to leave. And this guy kind of freaked me out. Like, he was intense, and we know that he works for the Merovingians, so he's probably not like the best guy/program out there. But I thought that the chase between Morpheus and Trinity and this guy, the train man, and then the transition into the train station, all of that was like very interesting. And I liked how we kind of jump from one place to another with the train. Like, the transitions here I thought were really good. But Morpheus goes to visit the Oracle, and she looks different. This is not the same Oracle as last time, because she made a choice, and a choice that cost her more than she wanted it to. So what did you guys think about this idea that she looks different, and that it's a repercussion of something that, you know, she decided to do in the last movie?
At first, I was wondering Like, we didn't know at first what exactly the consequence was. We knew our result of that was that she looked different. So my first thought was, did she die? And now has come to some new body, because she didn't seem to like fully know herself in this new body. Like, she was forgetting things, it seemed like she didn't know everything she used to know. And then we find out later, I think, that the Merovingian just ripped her shell away from her, which, if that was all it is, it's interesting that a program would have such an affinity for one shell, if that just means like the look of a body.
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know if this was because she, you know, the actor couldn't do it, like if they like shoehorned this in, or if it was like they made a choice to be like, if this was plot driven first, or if this was their excuse for the actor not coming back.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you that, whether you knew that or not, because that was my main question.
I was going to look it up. I think Leo said it was the actor couldn't come back, but I'll check.
She died in 2001.
Oh, okay.
Oh, well, if she died, I mean, that sucks, but understandable. But also, I thought these two movies were filmed as one unit.
She may have died in the midst of it, though, 2001.
Yeah, I was under the impression, because The Matrix Reloaded came out in 2003, right? So they were filmed in...
Yeah, so she died during filming.
Yeah, that sucks. Concurrently with the filming of the sequel. Yeah, so they did. They filmed they did film 2 and 3 together in between March 2001 and August 2002. So they spent a year and a half filming the two movies as one unit, and they didn't get put out until 2003 and 2005 or whatever it was. However, yeah, she must have died mid-block of that whole filming period. So it's kind of, yeah, interesting that they were able to get the coherent story, I guess, from.
Yeah, I really wouldn't have second-guessed that. Like, it just made sense to me plot-wise. It felt very seamless. It didn't feel like something that they had to scramble to put together. So I think it worked pretty well for me.
Yeah. Oh, no, they actually did release both movies in 2003, sorry. Like, but yeah, they filmed it all as one block, and so they must have been filming either vaguely in order or just were able to make it work. And I guess maybe they weren't planning to recast her when she passed away and then had to rewrite some stuff for go back over and redo the stuff for episode 3, maybe. But...
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, she was really good, the original one, and they did manage to kind of make this quite, they weren't just like, oh, it's me, I've got a different body now. They really hammered it in as a plot point. Uh-huh. So
I think that's why I appreciated it so much. And I really liked the original Oracle. Like, I liked the actress. I liked the way she spoke and her mannerisms and everything. And with this new shell, I thought the actress did a good job of being a little bit different, but still a little bit the same. Like she says, you know, I still like the candy and stuff like that. But she did speak a little different and she kind of held herself a little differently. And it was cool. Like I said, I think it really worked for me. But the Morpheus and Trinity, they have to go visit the Merovingian now. And they go through, as Kendra puts it, the most exciting coat check ever at the party palace. And this was our first major fight scene, really. And we see people on the ceiling and there's lots of guns and everything's going a little bit crazy. I think this really worked as like the introductory fight scene, and it wasn't, you know, too much, but it was enough to remind you that, hey, we're in the Matrix and people can walk across ceilings.
Yeah, it was hectic, and yeah, it was now interesting.
The Merovingian party is So good. And I have a lot of feelings about this scene. Mm-hmm. I know that some of this has to do with our favorite lines and everything. But in terms of these guys walking into this party where they're completely surrounded and basically having to trust the Merovingian that they will be allowed to escape unharmed as long as they can come to some sort of agreement, you can tell that they really don't want to lower their guns, but they do in the hopes of getting out there without a major fight. And I just have to say, this guy is so pretentious. He bothers me so much. I don't know why him eating half an olive at a time drove me crazy.
He's iconic. He's very famous as a movie villain. So yeah,
just oh god. But I hate him so much. I guess that's the point. You are supposed to hate him.
What did
but
you
yeah.
think of Persephone going back to him?
That was interesting.
Yeah,
I wonder. You know, you can tell she's still very hung up on the idea of love and her eyes kind of light up when she sees Trinity and what Trinity is willing to do for it. But yeah, mm-hmm. why do you think that she did go back to her or back to him?
Nowhere else to go. It's just what yeah. they, you know, how many times has she attempted to fuck him over and that they've gotten back together? Like it's interesting.
Like, could it be her program's like purpose reboot? To be with him?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, how horrible is that though? Like your program's purpose is to be with this guy that you hate and you can't change that fact.
Yeah. It's interesting that they can have ill will toward their purpose if that mm-hmm. is the case.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just found it interesting to see her again there and kind of, you know, she still kind of feels like she knows a bit more or like, you know, she's obviously sort of stuck, but feels like, you know, she's like resentful, but yet there. And it's, I don't know, it's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I agree. Although I kind of like her though, maybe because she is fighting against him and she doesn't want to be there. I think that she's just kind of an interesting character that we don't get to see too much of, but I do like the way that, like I said, her eyes sort of light up when Trinity enters the room and when it's obvious how far Trinity will go to save Neo. And this is the part that I have a lot of feelings about because Trinity did pretty much the stupidest thing she could do, which was try to take on that room full of armed people when she had no guns. Of course, she's amazing, so she kind of gets the upper hand. But the way that she grabs that gun and swings it and lands it right on his forehead, like, there are few things greater than that in life, I think. And I was like pumping my fist in the air. I thought it was awesome. But what did you guys think of this? Do you think Trinity did something really stupid or were you confident that she made the right choice?
I mean, they're there to save Neo and like the stakes are pretty high for everyone. So I think she had to do what she had to do. And she obviously was willing to risk everything. So I think she did the exact right thing and she did it awesomely.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're at the point where no decision is a stupid decision because you just have to make one. And if you can do it with a little flair, then more points to you.
I struggle with Trinity as a character in general. I just don't believe that she's in love with him. Like I just never have. She does something about that character. She's so dispassionate that I never buy her feelings at all. So basically nothing about Trinity and Neo's love story has ever worked for me ever. I don't know if it's because they were like veiling this incredibly queer story within a heterosexual couple or whether it's just Carrie Ann Moss and the way she plays the character, but I see her as completely asexual and aromantic. And maybe that is like unfair on people who aren't very demonstrative but still feel things a lot inside, but I don't get any feeling from her pretty much at any point ever in the entire trilogy.
I think we were having a conversation about this before the podcast started, because I think Brittany and Kendra, I think you guys kind of feel the same way.
Even when she was dying, I was like, does this woman have emotions? Why am I getting more from Keanu's like third of his face?
I feel like also that's like kind of unfair, because some people are like just not that demonstrative, but they still have like a lot of inner life. But I've just never bought it. I've just never bought that they're that in love. Like, I just, maybe she doesn't show it in a way that we think people in movies need to show it. I don't know. Karen, what do you think?
I actually feel kind of the opposite way as you guys. Not that I don't think that it could have been better and there could have been more on-screen chemistry and tension, because I definitely do think there should have been. But for me, Trinity's love story specifically, like her side of it, has always been more about action to me. And it's what she decides to do for Neo, no matter the consequences, no matter the risk, that has always spoken to me most. I agree that she doesn't really have a lot of emotion on her face. And even during the death scene, like, she is sort of just hanging out there with all these, like, you know, steel bars through her chest.
But steel arm things.
Yeah. But I kind of like that about her. I think that I really always sort of appreciated that she wasn't a very like weepy woman, a very emotional person. And while I think those sort of female characters have had their time, and that I'm kind of beyond that now. I like more vulnerable, emotional women who still get shit done. I still appreciate her character, and I do still like her love story, though I think that it's more about them telling us how much that they're in love than the characters actually showing it, except through some of their actions.
And I also, I don't know if for me, it's like just the way that stuff's usually coded in media. Like, I can't tell if this is like not good or if it's like experimental and too good for me to understand in terms of like being something outside the box in how we code in media what love means and like what kind of romantic things should be shown, or like what kind of action or speech or emotion or tropes make us like really heartfelt believe in a love story. They don't do that. And I can't tell if that's like a failing or if that's like them trying to be like more advanced and outside the box of, you know, paint by numbers emotional coding in media, if you know what I mean. And either way, it doesn't really work for me, but I can't tell if I'm the problem or if they are, like if I'm too stupid or if they didn't quite get it. But I will say as well, I also think part of it for me is like, and again, it's the traditional coding, that kind of badass, get shit done, no feelings, but like that kind of attitude for her is like a really traditional lesbian coding in cinema for like many, 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 many years to go. And the fact that we have this like cisgender heterosexual couple, which I don't necessarily think the Wachowskis think of these people as cisgender heterosexual people, but they are being portrayed that way, if you know what I mean. Like, so it's kind of difficult for me. Like, I don't, like, I feel like the Matrix in the Wachowskis' head is like not quite the Matrix that we got on screen. Or like they are using these kind of actors to tell a story that they have coded differently in their own minds, or even just to say this is how it should be for all people, or this, or like in anything can be anything. But yeah, I don't know, maybe I'm too locked into the norms of media to get it. But I kind of feel like I can see like a glimpse of what they're going for. I just don't know if I'm with them on it. But there's a lot of coding that's just not the way that we usually see this kind of couple.
Mm-hmm. I think that you're right to an extent, because I wouldn't be surprised if there was sort of some red tape or some things that they couldn't do or didn't feel comfortable doing at the time. Like, I can understand that maybe this was meant to be a little bit more than what actually we got on the screen. At the same time, I think I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, because in my mind, Trinity was always a very different female character. Like, she was so strong and she was so independent. And in a time when we didn't have a lot of female action heroes, she kind of stuck out to me, which is why I will be like, okay, well, maybe this is on purpose. But at the end of the day, unfortunately, I don't know that we'll ever really know the true story there.
I mean, Karen, you're not like a big love story person anyway. So how does that work for you?
Yeah. I mean, I do enjoy a love story every once in a while. I'm not like a crazy romance person. I think I've gotten better over the years because Kristen makes me watch things. But I'm so action oriented that I tend to be like, okay, like, fight the bad guys. You can kiss at the end. And like, I'll be happy with that. But like, I still swoon sometimes. There's no swoon moments in this movie.
Yeah, that's fair.
Except for maybe some side characters a little bit. But yeah, with Trinity and Neo, there really isn't. So maybe that's part of it, is like, I just never really needed them to be all over each other. Like, it was more about just sticking together and doing what they had to do, and no matter the consequences or the risks. And to me, that's love.
Fair enough.
Okay, let's switch gears here a little bit and talk about Smith, because I had some interesting thoughts on Smith in this movie. And one of them is that Smith is, so when the movie starts, Smith is an antagonist and he is kind of part of the system. He is an extension of the system, but he's also trying to break free of it. And
he's not trying to break free of it until Neo warps his mind.
Right, right. But he's always been a little bit different, I think, than the other agents. And he becomes this virus and we see him replicate and everything. And at the end of the day, he's almost more of a villain than the machines.
Yeah, it actually reminded me, because I saw Shang-Chi yesterday for the first time. Mm-hmm. I managed to get it at the cinema, and then I came home and watched this, and I'm like, oh, it's the same movie. It's like, it's not the same movie, but it's like at the climax, there's, you know, we've got our main goodies and we've got our main antagonistic force. And then they band together to fight a bigger problem who wants to kill all of them. Because that happens in the end of Shang-Chi, and it happens here in this movie with when, you know, ultimately the machine world, the Matrix God, helps Neo to wipe out Smith and pulls all of the, Matrix attacking people away from Zion. Like, it's kind of, Smith is the real primary antagonist, I would say, like, and this movie kind of hammers home that maybe the Matrix as a concept isn't that bad. Like, just the fact that it's a fake world, maybe it's not that bad compared to Smith.
Yeah, Smith kind of does go off the rocker a little bit in this movie, especially. I think he just kind of becomes more and more insane as things go on. And we see in his conversation between him and the Oracle some of the concepts that they talk about. And Kendra, I know you had some thoughts on, like, why the Oracle is helping Neo and how things end up turning out, and the idea of not being able to see beyond a choice that they can't understand. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Maybe some of this was more questions than answers. So
okay.
Maybe not, but yeah, she was talking about nobody can see beyond a choice they don't understand. So I was wondering, like, is her choice to help Neo? 'Cause to me in this scene, this is the first time the Oracle and Neo, their goals actually align. because before the Oracle was probably like prompting Neo to do what the other ones have done, although I did recently see a compelling theory for otherwise, but anyway.
Oh, do you think, so do you think that her guidance in the first two movies was to get him to sacrifice himself and reboot the Matrix?
Potentially.
Like to fulfill the prophecy of the one that way?
Potentially, yes.
Okay.
Like, I don't know that their goals fully aligned, or I don't think Neo ever really knew what his goal was, but now I think their goals do align, because her goal always is for peace between the humans and the machines in some way. And now that means that Smith needs to be eradicated. And that's the same thing for Neo.
And yeah, I think that that's very much like why we have spent the last three movies kind of getting more and more and more evidence that machines, that yes, the system that they live inside is fucked with the whole human batteries thing, but that A, the experiences and emotions of the people wired into the Matrix are still like real for them, and B, that those same experiences, fit and feelings and stuff can be developed into personhood by like non-organic meat humans. Like the people in the Matrix might not be human bodies, but they are programs with sentience and, you know, they have rights and feelings and stuff. And we keep basically building that. And I think that the end goal of building that is to say, like, maybe the Matrix is okay because these people have rights to exist. I don't know. It's kind of weird. And that's kind of why it ends up with where it ends up, like with the new Matrix and, you know, all of that stuff.
One question,
like, the machines aren't the enemy. I don't know, but they are. It's weird. It's like a bad system that they have to live within. I don't know.
One question I did have about this scene that I thought was interesting is that when Neo arrives, she said that she thought the cookies would be done by the time he got there, which was weird. And then the cookies were done by the time Smith got there. So,
was she expecting them to both come up at the same time, or like,
or can she even differentiate between the two because they are the opposite of each other?
Yeah. Huh.
That is a good question. I never considered that, but they are both anomalies in different ways. And she sees the Matrix in such an interesting way. That's actually one of the reasons why I really liked this scene, is because for the first time, we're seeing the Oracle, who doesn't necessarily have all the answers. Like, especially in the first movie, the Oracle is so calm, so collected, tells everyone exactly what they need to hear. And then it's, you know, out of her hands, it's up to them to do what they need to do. And now we're seeing an Oracle where life's a little more complicated, and she doesn't necessarily know what's going to happen beyond this next choice. Because as we see, Agent Smith takes her over and she is no more. And she knew that was happening. She knew that was coming. And then by the end of the movie, you know, we kind of figure out that she didn't necessarily know that this was the outcome. She had hoped it would be, but she doesn't have all the answers anymore. So Brittany, what did you like this scene between Smith and the Oracle, and how are you feeling about this different version of the Oracle? Not necessarily that she has a different shell, but that she's maybe a little less all-knowing than we thought she was in the first movie.
Well, a lot of her opinions or predictions or however programming in the first two films was very much left to just these loose questions. And I think that that's a theme throughout all of these movies. It's like, here's a big idea, but I don't have all the details. I can hazily put together a picture, but I know where the key players are. So she's basically like operating as if she lost her glasses, let's say. Like, I could see a shape, but I think it resembles you. And to have this Oracle who just is expressing doubt, like, to the point where it's like, okay, now I'm not even sure if the blob is a person. I think it's more, it could be anything. It could be a column that is in my line of sight and not an actual, not Smith, not Neo. I think it's operating in a very tighter storyline than, let's say, the last movie. So like the second movie dealt with all of, proposed all of these big questions and made you want to like go and stare out a window for a while contemplating the meaning of the universe, whereas this one is sort of just like very cut and dry. I do not know, and we don't have time to think about it. And I liked that there was just this like dead set uncertainty instead of well, maybe she knows more than she's letting on. We're very much determined that she doesn't know what's coming, and I liked that a lot more in this movie. As in terms of Smith, every time he came on the scene, I was so used to just, especially in the last movie, just tuning him out because I had no idea what his deal was. And so it's just like, oh, this guy again, he's gonna pretend to be bad, or is he bad? I don't, he's just annoying.
No, he's so interesting. I disagree so much, but go on.
Yeah, I do not like him. I still don't know his purpose. I literally just couldn't get invested in his character any less than I did, but it could just be Matrix fatigue at this point. However, this was one scene that I did actually like in the movie. So
What about him calling the Oracle mom?
But well, he was meant to be channeling Seraph there. Like, he'd taken over Sati and Seraph, like, cause he took over everyone in the whole thing. Like, you know, he was like, when he was like, cookies need love, like, that was Sati. Like, he was basically saying to her, I've eaten them both. It's very weird. But I think he's interesting because it's this, like I said last time, the rage he has, he has such rage and destruction and just anger, fury at the system now that he's been brought a level of personhood into the system. Like, Neo made him think and feel in movie one. Neo made him like awake, made him conscious, made him a person. And the person that he is very fucking angry. Like, the person that he is like just absolutely raging at the system and the fact that everything is the way it is. Like, he feels unsure. He is rattled in his purpose. He's rattled in his confidence. And he's going to make that everyone else's problem because he doesn't like having feelings and having to think about choices or, like, any of that. And I mean, same, but I don't go and try and burn the world down. But, you know.
I was going to say, maybe that's why I liked him too, because
I find him really interesting because I see that archetype so clearly of he was unaware, and awareness has made him very angry at the system, at the circumstance that he is within. Fury at the fact that things can't just be ordered and regulated, and fury that he has feelings, fury that he's being driven by the same thing that drives the, you know, people with messy human gelatin cow eyes and whatever the fuck that horrific line was. But yeah, it's just, he's so rage driven. Like, he got given emotion and given perspective and given choice, and he is really angry about that. He just wants to be put back in a box, but he's not going to be put back in a box. He's going to tear the whole world down because he's so angry at the lack of order.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me.
Yeah. I think that he was a character that could have been fairly one-dimensional and ended up being extraordinarily complex. And I do think it aids the story overall. And especially, like I said, when we get to the fact that, like, he was almost a worse antagonist than the machine world was, and how they all three of those powers with Neo and, you know, the humans kind of being the third, how that ended up working out in the end, I think is just a really interesting ending to the series. But speaking of humans, let's leave the Matrix behind for a little while and talk about the real world. And we actually, in the movie, do leave the Matrix behind and Neo behind for quite a while. So basically, Human Smith, aka Bane, has woken up and he's being interrogated about the cuts on his arms. We check in with Niobe and the team, who are safe and alive. Machines are incoming, and Neo decides that he needs to take a ship to the machine city and
go to the source or whatever it is.
Yeah. And the other captain thinks that he's crazy, but Niobe offers up her ship and then decides that she's going to pilot the one that they're on and make it back to Zion in time to hopefully save everyone. And she believes in Neo. And I think we see a little bit of the faith that Morpheus has always had in Neo in her. And I kind of liked that. I really liked this character a lot because, again, another very strong and capable woman in the movie. And she kind of always steps up. And she's tough and she doesn't let people talk shit. And, you know, so she was, I think, a lot of fun. And I'm glad that she was in the movie. But what do you guys think about Niobe?
I mean, I think that she's really cool. And I liked all of the interactions between her and Roland, the captain of Mjolnir ship. Yeah, I thought it was good.
Don't know. I also really liked her. I definitely found myself more drawn to the supporting characters in this movie than the main characters, like Niobe, Link and his wife, even like the Merovingian and his crew were like kind of cool in this one. They, I don't know, they just seemed more interesting in as people, whereas like the Matrix, the main Matrix cast are just like so intense that I and Niobe is one of my favorites.
Yeah, obviously the rest of the side cast is kind of like normal people having to deal with all the shit that's going down, whereas like the Nebuchadnezzar crew, like Trinity and Morpheus and then Neo, were kind of these weird like religious zealot prophecy people who everyone thought was a bit weird. So there's also that still going on, whereas these people being like, ah, shit, gotta fight for my home, like don't really know about the bigger deal prophecies, but you know, here's where we are, and that's kind of more rich and passionate, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Rich and passionate, because I have to say in the second movie, I didn't really care about Zion that much. Like I knew I was supposed to, and obviously I didn't want all those people to die, but there was a different emotional resonance in the first or in the third movie. And I think part of that was because we do cut back to them for such a long time, but also there are a lot of other factors going on here. Going back to the Oracle, like we were saying before, there isn't as much certainty there. And I think that raises the stakes a lot. And it does make you go, oh, maybe not everything is going to work out the way that we want it to. But also, this is the real world. It's dirtier. It's, you know, a lot more browns and grays and everything. It's not as shiny as the Matrix. They feel so much more real, and the death there is so much more real. Like, obviously, if you die in the Matrix, you die in the real world, but they can do crazy flips and get away from people. And, you know, all they need to do is find a payphone and they can get out of there. Whereas the real world, like, they had to make that stand. And for the first time, I think I cared more than I did any other time we went back to the real world.
Yeah, there's definitely a point later in the film where Neo is doing like a real world fight. And I'm like, dude, you can't fight in the real world. Like you can't do it. Like you're not gonna like but yeah, it definitely like seeing all of those like, you know, normal little people with their normal little stakes, you know, getting in there like Jaeger type machine things, like or like carrying their little guns and wheeling their little trolleys. It's yeah, it feels like more heightened, I guess. And, you know, I definitely liked everyone that we spent time with in the real world this time. Like, we liked, Z and her little shaved head friend, and we liked the kid and Mifune and even Locke. Like, I had a couple of my favorite lines in the movie were from Locke trying to be like, you guys think you're doing all this grand and noble shit, but we are actually... we have some big problems here and we just got to handle them. Like, you know, like it was kind of,
I thought it was slightly less insufferable, this movie.
That, you know, the reality of, I mean, I'm probably not going to pick this as my very favorite line, but I really liked when he was like, unlike you, I don't have the privilege of hope or something like that. Like he said, like, you know, because everyone was being a bit all arty farty and like, you know, we're going to, you know, just believe and Neo can do it, or like, you know, whatever the hell he was doing. But he was like, basically like, just got to do the thing practically. Like, can't just, hope is an indulgence I don't have time for. That's what he said. Mm. And I was like, that's fucking, yeah, I get it. I totally get you. I see you. Like, and so that was kind of interesting. And yeah, we followed a lot of people for, you know, their various tracks that I found, yeah, interesting, even if it did cut away from Neo for like a really long chunk of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Newbies, how did you feel about the humans? Were you worried for them? Did you like them better this time around than in the last movie, or have you loved them all along?
I definitely liked spending a little bit more time with them and knowing that these people, especially based off like that opening scene in the second movie where Neo comes back, like these people have a lot that they've lost and have been living without for such a long time. Like people still left in the Matrix, and, you know, then they're also, they got out, but now they're dealing with these other external threats. And they're just like common people trying to build their lives. And then, you know, they're also waiting for this moment. These clearly, a big group of them have been in training for several years and decades waiting for this attack. And they've been working at that the whole time. And now it's real and they're prepared to die. And it's very, I thought that those like rallying scenes were more moving because of that. And because we only got these small glimpses of what is being protected. Because, you know, we spend a lot of time in the Matrix in the first two movies, and it's a very different reality when you're looking at like the pit of people versus the like people who are look like they're leading seemingly normal lives that we're used to seeing in our daily life in the Matrix. So, yeah, I liked spending a lot of time with them, especially the characters that we've come to know. And I thought Niobe had a great role in sort of grounding Morpheus, because I feel like he could have gone like off the rails in this movie because
definitely. So much,
just the fact that, you know, he lost so much in that last movie where everything that he's been working towards and following and believing in was sort of like knocked off its axis. Mm-hmm. And so in this movie, to have her being like, no, I do still believe in what was at the heart of what you believed. It may not be the same, but it's tangentially related. But also now we need to be physically fighting and doing something else. Yeah, so
that's the key for me. It's like, you can't just meditate until Neo magically saves everyone or right. whatever. Like, she kind of makes him actually work. And I kind of like that, you know. There were, you know, some other human characters here that we spent time with, like Link's wife, Z, and the kid. And I want to just say something about the kid quickly. This is Neo's groupie, right? He is, in the second movie, we heard, like, what do we hear? We said, you know, oh, you saved me. And no, and then they're like, you saved yourself. That kid has a whole backstory, and he has an episode of The Animatrix, which is a series of shorts that are set before, during, and after the Matrix series, which are like a canonical timestamp series that was put out around the Matrix. And the kid's very interesting because he is one of very few people, and they don't say it in this film, but it's true. He is one of very few people who achieved what they call self-substantiation, which is removing yourself from the matrix without external aid. Like, no one came and found him and gave him a red pill. He literally broke himself out of it with the strength of his own mind. So this kid is like a big deal, and we don't actually see that in the film, but it is true of him, and it's what it meant when they said, you know, you saved yourself. He's under some sort of like delusion, or like just his own perception of what happened is that he chased Neo down and Neo saved him, but he actually threw himself out of the matrix under the strength of his own mind, which is why he's like kind of important, I guess, a big deal.
That's and so weird considering everybody treats him like crap.
Apparently later in the series, he's like apparently there's, you know, canon stuff later as well, where he's like upset that Neo gave up and like threw himself into the matrix or whatever you want to call it. But it's interesting. So he's actually got quite a lot of, interesting qualities to him. So he's like quite a special kid who, yeah, they do kind of treat him like nothing. But yeah, I don't know if that was always decided for him or if they decided that later, but that's his deal. That he believes Neo saved him, but it was actually, he actually threw himself out on his own. So he's like very strong minded. So yeah, he's someone that apparently he has at least a cameo in the next movie, in movie 4 this year. And I would kind of like it if he had a bigger role.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
That does make me like him more. I didn't really care about him in the second movie. I mean, you don't see him a whole much, but he, you know, he does kind of just seem like a groupie, but this one, he definitely steps into his own. And my favorite scene has to do with him and what he does. So knowing a little bit more of his backstory definitely makes it more interesting.
Mm.
I can't remember if I saw any of the Animatrix stuff. I feel like I did, but I don't remember any of it.
I can't really remember either, but yeah.
Okay, so let's stick with Zion for a bit, and then we'll go back to Neo after. But Kendra, I know you really liked Link and Z, right?
Yeah, I do.
And so what did you kind of think about their story in particular, but also just, again, like all of the humans back at Zion? Did you feel like the stakes were really high? Were you worried for them? Did you think Link and Z would come back together again?
I mean, obviously I was hoping. I thought the action sequence at Zion was really well done. And actually the first time it was interesting how long they did cut away from Keanu, because when I started this scene in this watch, like I was kind of expecting it to be going between all three, like going between Zion, the Mjolnir coming back, and Neo and Trinity. But Neo and Trinity are just completely out of it. Like, we're focused on Zion and the Mjolnir trying to get back into Zion for a long, long time. And even so, even though it was long, like, I thought they did a really good job of continuing to raise the stakes and the action and putting in moments with characters that we had grown to care about at that point. Like, we get Z and then the kid and Mifune, I think his name is. Like, all of these characters have such epic moments within this battle. And I really loved their Transformery battle suits, too. I thought that was cool. The CGI as a whole wasn't awesome, but I didn't mind it too bad with the machine stuff. So all in all, I really liked it.
Good. Yeah, I felt like even though this was a very long action scene, it didn't feel too long like the one in the second movie did. And I think that because it was on a grander scale and the stakes were like much higher for a lot of different people, and you had it intercutting back to Niobe and everything that was going on there, it made it feel a little bit more, I don't know. It felt like there was so much going on that you didn't really have time to take a breath and to stop and go, I'm bored, or like, there's too much going on. And because we got to see close-ups of different characters and what was going on with them, you were constantly worried for everyone's lives. I would like to give a shout out to Chara, who was the woman with the shaved head with the great arms, because I could watch an entire movie about her. I don't know what it is, but she, I felt like her little bit in the movie had so much weight. Like there was a lot of weight on her shoulders, and you could tell she had been through some shit, and we don't really know anything about her, but I want to, like, I want to know how her and Z know each other. And I want to know what drove her to be a part of this. And her death was very sad. I knew she wasn't going to make it, but I was still hoping that she would get to that door fast enough, and she didn't. But yeah, I think this scene really worked for me in a lot of different ways. And I think it really came down to a lot of these side characters, which kind of in the end became a little bit more important overall. But Brittany, what did you think of this big battle sequence?
I did my dishes and it was long. I mean,
It was long.
Okay.
But there were nice little face bits in between, but it was long.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And every time a nice little face bit happened, I like paused and focused in ready for something. And then it went back to loud noises. So then I went back to doing some things, but yeah, I got a lot of housework done during it. So
good job. Good. You were multitasking. It was productive. Yeah.
And it did, like, you know, I did keep looking back and forth, but, you know, been burned with the first two movies needing to be cut down a little bit. But yeah, I think having some investment in certain characters over others made some of the sequences like a little bit easier to watch. And I did like that we cut back and forth instead of sticking on someone for so long in some of them. So that helped a lot. I think that that was a huge advantage that this film had over some of the others, where you were just like a GoPro on one of those characters. You just, you were there and there was no getting off the train. So here, at least, you know, it got broken up a little bit, but yeah, they were a little bit more tolerable, but again, because I was burned so much by the first two movies, I did start putting some stuff away and
doing some housework.
Yeah,
that's fair. I think that one of the things that the second movie does well for the third movie is set up some of these characters ahead of time. Like, we don't really care about them too much in the second movie, but we needed that background information and we needed the setup of like Link leaving Z and all of that to care more in the third movie. So while the second one is a little bit transitionary, I think that it works as a back-to-back thing so that you do care by the time we get some of those close-ups in this scene. Yeah, so Niobe arrives and she hits that EMP and she saves everyone. And it, well, okay, Morpheus hits the EMP and they save everyone. They did it together. Yay, we should celebrate. Except, oops, maybe this wasn't the right call. See, I think they had to do this, right? Like, it was do this and try to figure out how to fix it afterwards or potentially die right then and there, right? Like, there was no other option besides the EMP. They were losing.
Yeah, even Locke, I think, said to do it. So at that point,
like, because he says it later, he's like very angry about it later.
I think he was like, we can't do it. Like, we have to hold the dock. And then they're like, we already lost the dock. And he was like, let them in. I'm pretty sure is what happened.
Yeah. I guess it's just kind of like you had to do it, but it's still sort of sucked that you...
Yeah.
But yeah, he, I mean, because later, I can't remember who says what, but yeah, later he's like, well, you know, they're like, we saved everyone. He's like, you didn't fucking save everyone. We've just handed it to them on a silver platter. Like, it's difficult. But it's like, what else were you going to do? Like, you know?
Yeah. I really, truly don't think they had another choice there. And luckily, you know, that's kind of where Neo comes in and he ends up saving the day. So, you know, and other than that, wife reunited and he's never taking the necklace off, which was pretty funny, and it was very satisfying to see those two back together again. But do you guys have any more opinions on this sequence before we switch back over to Neo?
I have this in my favorite scenes, but just in general, Niobe's driving the ship and Roland and Morpheus being like, oh my God, this woman's driving. Like, I didn't know the ship could do that. Like, when she flips it and stuff. I really enjoyed all of that getting home.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed Roland, the other captain, the kind of posh guy, and his delivery in conjunction to her was like very funny to me. His whole attitude, like he wasn't a bad guy. It was just funny to me.
Yeah, I didn't necessarily like him, but I think that he was necessary to give it a little bit more of that like pushback, because they couldn't make it too easy, and you needed one person to be at least somewhat reasonable, because what they were doing was pretty crazy.
Yeah,
but she pulled it off.
I actually really liked him. Not like liked him, like I wouldn't want to like hang out with him, but like I liked I liked what they did there. Yeah,
he was a bit of a downer.
Yeah, so am I. It's fine.
Natalie,
what?
You're not a downer.
Okay, if you say so.
Okay, so we know that Neo needed to take a ship to go to the Machine City, and he takes Niobe's ship, and Trinity goes with him. And he doesn't think that he's going to come back, but Trinity's going anyway. They go together. It's great. They love each other.
Mm-hmm.
However, they run into a little complication in that Bane, aka Human Smith, is a stowaway on their ship. And like, we need to talk about how good he was at emulating.
He was hired for that. Yes. So his name's Ian Bliss. Mm-hmm. And we looked this up yesterday, and he got the job because of how good his impersonation was of Hugo Weaving. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't just like some random.
Yeah.
They cast for this and they did it very well.
Oh yeah. You know? It was so good because
I was just are they dubbing his voice, but no, it was.
Yeah. Real. You just immediately understood, like when he switched off from pretending to be Bane and was himself as like Smith, like you could tell the moment it happened. Like, it just blew my mind.
Yeah, and I mean, that kind of is like, can programs okay, go with me on this.
Okay.
If programs are capable of taking over a human body in the real world, is this just something that happened because Smith got corrupted, or could like Sati find like a brain dead coma victim and like have a body in the real world, if you know what I mean?
I want to say it's because he's corrupted. Like, whatever changed in Smith was why he could do this.
Yeah.
I want to say that it would be possible. Like, I think a lot of what's happening in this movie is like the lines blurring. And I think that's a part of it.
Yeah. I mean, a big part of it, like I've said, is like, are these people people? Like, are the machine people, are the programs people? And, you know, here is a program existing in a body in the real world. And it's like, where do we go from there? But he obviously is corrupted, and he was also corrupted by Neo. Like, that's the thing. The fact that Neo is the one that kind of rejigged his programming, it's like, is there some special, like, Neo dust on him that makes him, like, more, you know, like, you know, one power sprinkle? And is it like, is it like, like he's got like the magic, you know, like, or something. Like, I don't know. Do you know what
Neo
I mean?
Dust. Yeah, I just can't get over Neo dust. It's so visual in my mind that like little I'm holding
sprinkle.
On to that forever.
Green sprinkle.
Yeah. That's a good question. And I think that, Kendra, you're right about like the blurring of the lines. And I think that that is part of the point of this movie is, I don't know, at least for me, like the Matrix, the actual foundation of the Matrix and the explanation behind it has always been very difficult for me to grasp. And I don't know if I'm just not smart enough, which is like totally fair, but there's just a lot going on here. It's so complicated. And I'm always amazed by how detailed it is and how complicated it is. But I think a part of it too is like, maybe we're not necessarily supposed to have all the answers, and that things are blurrier.
Yeah, I actually completely agree with that. I think that they're not trying to make you understand everything. And I think that maybe that's one of the reasons why these are go above people's heads a bit because you look, or maybe back then people didn't. Maybe it's like today's audience like wants everything handheld for them, and people aren't very comfortable just sitting there accepting that they don't understand. And
yeah.
I think people have gotten worse in that department. So again, the fourth one, I'm interested to see how they approach that in like today's media society.
Yeah, I totally agree. Okay, well, as long as we're on the same page about not necessarily understanding everything, I'm much happier now. But yeah, so back to Bane. Basically, he stows away on the ship and he and Trinity and Neo fight and he blinds Neo. But Neo can still see things that are connected to the source, including Smith, which I love that the like version of him had the sunglasses on. That was so funny
flaming
to me.
Sunglasses.
Yeah. And he defeats him. He defeats Bane, but he's blind now. What do we think about that? Do we have feelings?
He's going to be dead soon. He's fine. I mean, he didn't seem to be too upset about it. Yeah, it's tough to care too much because, again, he's going to be dead soon and it doesn't look like he's blind when he comes back in the fourth one.
That's the thing. I'm like, what's happening? I mean, Trinity looks very alive in the fourth one too. So, like, now, like, after having rewatched this last night, I'm just like, what the fuck are they going to even do? Like, is it all set like within the Matrix? Like, is it like a rebooted, literally, like, are they rebooted versions of themselves? Because I'm like, are you just going to like pretend the third movie didn't happen? Like, is there going to be a massive retcon? Is this a waste of everyone's time, us doing this podcast? Because what the hell are they going to do?
Well, this is like jumping ahead, but this movie doesn't not set up a next one. Like there are a couple things at the end that are like, oh, there's more coming. So like something was planned. Who knows what it is?
Yeah. I kind of like that Neo is blinded. I think that it adds to the fact that like he's invincible and that this is the real world and bad things can still happen. It definitely gives me like Daredevil vibes with what he sees through his eyes and also like the thing around his just got the Daredevil vibes there, but I liked it. It was a look and it sucks for him, but you're right. He didn't seem like super concerned about it. He was like, I can still see.
Casual. It was also like, I'm okay, but you're going to have to drive.
Yeah.
I found that very sweet in a way.
Is that the only joke Neo's ever made?
Maybe. Was it a joke? Who knows?
Yeah.
It's the only joke Keanu Reeves has ever made in his acting career. And it was delivered perfectly.
Do you think Keanu never plays characters who are jokey?
I mean, he is literally like what Bill and Ted, like he does.
Well, that's the thing, but Bill and Ted, he's not making jokes. He is a joke, but he's quite earnest. Like,
yeah, I just feel like it didn't suit him.
Like, he's been in movies where he is the comic character, kind of. Like that one with Randall Park. What's that movie called?
Oh,
Always Be My Maybe?
He's playing himself.
He was playing a comic character for us to laugh at, but he wasn't like cracking jokes, you know, like he was not full of humor himself. So I don't know. It's interesting. I feel like he would be really good at being like a quiet, sly sort of humor. Like, you know, like just, you know, one of those people that like fires out quiet little zingers and you're like, oh my God, he just said that. Like, and I'd like to see a little of that from him, but yeah, he's not really a fun lover, is he?
Maybe Neo 2.0 in Matrix 4 will be a hilarious man,
just the life of the party, puns all over the place.
Yeah, dad jokes everywhere. Well, joke or not, it is true that he can't drive right now. So Trinity is driving and they do make it to Machine City, not before seeing the real sky, which was beautiful. And I loved the shot of Trinity's face as she takes it in and her eyes, and there's so much light on her and everything. It just like that moment really worked for me. And I liked that, you know, we learn in the first movie, like, we don't know. I think he says like, we don't know who shot first or something, but we know that we scorched the sky, and we actually see above the scorched sky now to what it looks like beyond that. And it is beautiful. And I love that Trinity got to see that, especially because she dies. This is what ruined the trilogy for me when I first watched these movies, and when we decided to do this, and when I knew that I was going to be a part of the Matrix rewatchable crew, I was worried about getting to this moment because I was really, really upset. And I remember my strongest feeling was being like, you killed her to save her in the second movie. Like, you killed her and then you saved her. It was high stakes. It was sad for a moment, but then it was, everything was okay, only to do the same thing again, to kill her and not be able to bring her back this time. And I remember it just being so upsetting and almost anticlimactic for me that I really hated this movie. I want to know what you guys thought, like your initial reactions when Trinity died. Did you care? Did you not care? Were you happy? Don't tell me you were happy.
This is the one thing that I was spoiled on from these movies. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. But it seemed, yeah, anticlimactic is a good word for it. This time, like, I did kind of feel it. Like, my eyes got a little moist at Trinity's death scene and in there. I would never call it banter, but their conversation afterwards was, I kind of felt that there might be something there for the first time ever. But yeah, I guess probably because it was spoiled, I didn't feel that much for her death, and probably because I already knew there was another movie coming. So it probably would have been a lot different seeing it at the time, like you did, Karen.
Yeah. Brittany, what about you? Did you know this was coming?
I feel after it happened, I was like, oh, right, she dies. But I didn't know that it was going to happen. I think mainly because, like, I wasn't waiting the whole movie anticipating it happening. I remembered after the fact. And I think I liked not knowing, because when it did happen, and this is something we kind of touched on a little bit earlier, there's just such a lack of emotion where I felt like she was sort of like, well, my life's tied up. I got my next of kin signed. Like, I did the whole like meet with the lawyers, hand over the will thing. I am at peace. I'm just going to go. And so it was anticlimactic in that way, but it was still like, you know, moving. I was waiting for like something to be like vengeful and like, screaming at the world, but it was sort of just like, okay, I'll leave you now. Like, I was like, all right, maybe I could have, I'm more of a sap. I would have enjoyed a little bit more emotion in the scene, but it did suck. I was not happy about it, but yeah, I was just sort of like, oh, this has happened. She seems fine with it. So I guess I have to be fine with it.
Yeah. I mean, my thing is that Neo definitely had to die because the whole series is a massive Christ metaphor. And there was no way to escape the fact that Neo was going to do something that gave his power back to save everyone and it would kill him. That was never a question for me. I don't know if Brittany or Kendra, if you kind of felt that sure about that, like the whole series, like watching it as a fresh view. Or did you think Neo was going to be alive at the end?
I knew from the start
that he would die.
But not because I'm smart, because I had been spoiled.
Okay. Brittany?
I did not know that he was going to die at all, and I didn't see it coming. And I think that also was kind of the fault of knowing that there was going to be a fourth movie, where I was just like,
that's true.
The first time watching these movies, I went in knowing that there's a movie coming out in month, or this month now, since we're recording in December. But like, you know, when we started, it was like 2 months away, and I was just like, there's a fourth movie. We're fine. I was like, you know, Trinity's in it, everything. So I was just like, everyone's kicking and having a great time.
That's valid, actually. But I don't know. He's it's a full-on savior story. So yeah, he had to die. And I'm kind of like, if he'd died and she'd lived, that would have been interesting. Like, you know, what she did next and all of that. Like,
yeah, it does like feed into the title too. Now all the titles make sense. Resurrections.
Well, yeah, I'm going to talk about that a bit in a second, actually, yeah. Because there's some stuff about that. But yeah, they are dead. They died. So maybe it's like Trinity had to die. It's not like her death feeds his story, which I think is good as well. It's not like she died so that he would do the thing. Like, he probably still would have done the thing anyway. Like, it's not like he was okay dying just because she died. Maybe he was. I don't know. But it wasn't like that was the thrust for him to go forward. It was just, shit happens.
It was an accident. Like, they hit the building and crashed and the things went through her chest. Like, and I guess in that, you're right. I do kind of like that aspect of it. It was a consequence of them going together. There was always a chance that they weren't going to return. It didn't fuel him. Like you said, I actually really liked how they filmed the scene, because you get a brief glimpse of those bars coming through the front of the ship and they both get blown back and you don't necessarily know that she was hit. And then the camera pans like up her legs and then to his face and then to her face, and they talk for a minute and he doesn't know that she's hurt yet. And then it kind of pans out and you see it, and it gives them a moment where like you kind of think maybe everything's okay. And then it rips it away from you. And of course, the first time I watched this, I hated that. It made me very upset. Second time I watched it, I think how many years ago was this? I think this movie came out in 2003. Like, I've made peace with it. And I ended up really liking what they did with it cinematically. Still don't love that she died, but I'm okay with it now. And I think
I'm kind of curious, like, how you feel about that as like a storyteller, like as in terms of like understanding more that, like, because, you know, your basic kind of approach is someone I like died and I'm mad about it, you know, like, as opposed to like the construct of like a story.
Yeah. I will say that. Okay, there's a balance, because I don't necessarily love when a character is killed for the sole purpose of fueling the main character. Like, a lot that happens with a lot of women. That's why we have the fridging trope, all of that.
Yeah.
However, I'm also mad that they killed her at the finish line. That felt unnecessarily cruel to me as somebody who loves this character. Like, why did you have to do it then? Like, I almost would have felt better if she had died in the second movie, even though I still would have been mad. And I don't know, if she had died in the second movie, maybe I would have been like, no, they should have made her last to the third movie and then killed her then or something. But they were so close to the end, and an accident kills her. It's just so upset. Yes, but it makes me mad. I love happy endings, and I think that The Matrix has a very realistic take on everything going on. Like, there are high stakes in this movie. A lot of people die. Bad things happen to these characters. Even in the first movie, some characters that were part of the crew, you know, a lot of people that we did like, they died. And that's just what happens. But I wanted my happy ending and I didn't get it. And I'm mad about it.
I understand. I don't think this was exactly a happy ending kind of series. Exactly. It's quite difficult. Like, and I don't know if it is a little bit to feed Neo's story, like severing every tie he has with being a person as opposed to just like the being that has to save the Matrix. You know, like nothing left to live for kind of thing, or what. But yeah, I don't know. I think part of it is also the reality that shit happens, especially in like messy war. But I understand that you didn't like it.
And yeah.
You didn't want it to happen.
But like I said, the second time around, I do kind of feel a little bit better about it, probably because I wasn't totally blindsided like I was the first time. And I think Neo's death feels a little bit the same way for me. And so let's talk about the final battle, because we get Neo making a deal with the machines to take out Smith and to live in peace, which, like I said, this is, you know, kind of a strange thing for them to be teaming up together, but Smith needs to be taken out. And we get the battle of them in the rain, which I will say is like pretty iconic for this series and definitely something that I has like lodged in my head for many, many years. And Neo just, you know, he won't die. He's still there. Smith is so angry. He doesn't understand. And Neo just tells him, like, you know, why do you, or he asks Neo, why do you keep fighting? Why do you choose to love? And Neo's just like, because I do. Like, it's just what I do. And we get the whole full circle moment of everything that has a beginning has an end, and it being inevitable, and these two battle it out. And I think in terms of a final battle sequence, it felt a little underrated for me. Not underrated, like the other scene was so big with all of those machines and everything blowing up and going crazy that this was a little bit of a quieter fight. Did you guys like that? Do you think it was a fitting final battle for the trilogy?
I did. Like, I like that this series ended on a battle that was more intellectual than like crash bang, like things blowing up. Like, this seemed more true as a final battle for the Matrix. Like, in a way it's like humans versus machines, but in a way it's not, and there's a lot of stuff that's like really hard to understand, but it's like it's kind of just as much a battle, a physical battle, as it is a battle of wits, and it more a battle of wits because Neo has to lose. Like, he's defeating Smith in a different way than meets the eye, which I thought made sense for this series.
Yeah. It's definitely like that bit where he kind of is like, with Smith's like, you know, I'm meant to say something to you here, because like he's taken over the Oracle and the Oracle mm-hmm. is like kind of infecting him in some way, like destabilizing him via personhood. And it's kind of interesting that level is quite interesting to me.
What'd you think, Brittany?
You know, when I'm on mute and I'm like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm like, they cannot hear me agreeing with their comments.
That's why I don't like to mute sometimes, because I like to make noises that like appreciate you.
Yeah, I agree with what Kendra was saying, especially where this wasn't just like blowing stuff up and getting lost in, you know, there's a lot of CGI, but it's also not as distracting in this scene as it would have been for, like, you know, with flames and things going down and trying to catch some background action. And it's very isolated and focused. And there are these stakes that you now, by the time you reach the scene, you're waiting to see how it's going to play out. And then when it clicks, what has to happen, it like has an emotional resonance. And so definitely one of the better fight scenes, if I had to rank them, which I won't do because it's just, there's too many. So yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good way to end the movie as well, because instead of, one thing I don't like about action movies, which I don't know, Karen, actually, if you'll disagree or agree, is I don't like when we're like walking out of the flames and like everyone is just ready to drop dead. And it's like, this, okay, now what type of thing. This felt like it rose the like to the climax so well and sort of just like stayed at that heightened state, but you didn't have that like immediate drop off of like, oh, now everything's resolved and everyone's happy. It was still very open-ended and like, is it actually okay? Like, did this work? And I have a lot more questions that could be asked, but also it could be over. I don't know. I felt like it had a very, like, it didn't drop down from that high of a battle at mm-hmm. the end, as most movies would for me.
I think that's fair. And I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that Neo also died. Like, you don't get that happy ending where the heroes walk away from everything and like, okay, you know, let's go out for drinks or something. Like, it's still sort of yearning for the next thing to happen, because it, not that it didn't feel like the end, but you know that there's fallout from this and you know that it will have repercussions, and you're kind of waiting for those waves to land. And I think that understated, that was the word that I was looking for like 5 minutes ago. I think this final battle is very understated because, like Kendra was saying, it's a battle of the wits. And even though there is physical fighting, the two of them each have a role to play, and they know part of it, but they don't know the complete picture until they're in the exact moment when they need to.
Yeah. And like, that's the thing with like the Oracle, like, you know, Smith gaining the Oracle's powers and being like, hang on, I've seen this before. What's meant to happen now? Like, and just the element of trickery, like the element of like, I'm going to get you to grab me and then we're going to fry me when you're in, you know, and yeah, just the whole thing. It does mix like a physical battle with kind of like tricky manipulative strategy, I guess, like, and playing on the emotion, playing on those elements of Smith that are like his weaknesses.
Yeah, definitely. And I think as we kind of wait to see what has actually become of everyone and everything, you're left kind of teetering on the edge a little bit still. So let's kind of take stock of what happens by the end of this. So Smith is gone. Neo is dead. The machines take Neo's body away. What do we think happens with that? Do you have any guesses?
Yeah, I don't know. Apparently, like, in there's like, and again, I feel like it's hard to say because the next movie is like probably going to do something weird with that. But apparently after the movie series finishes, the Wachowskis were like, the video game, like the MMORPG game, The Matrix Online, apparently in that there's like the machines took and stored Neo and Trinity's bodies somewhere. So apparently, you know, there's part of that that's like Morpheus is like on a quest to retrieve Neo's body and get the machines to repair them, you know. But I don't know, like, it's not in the movie, so like, how canon is it? But apparently, according to the Wachowskis, it is all canon, and it's confusing. By the end of this film, you know, the Zion people know that whatever Neo did worked and drew the machines away, but they don't actually know what happened to him at all. So it's sort of within their context, we don't know at all.
Interesting.
yeah, apparently they go went and stored them. So I don't know if that's going to be like something that ties into the new movie, or I'm pretty sure the new movie is not going to have to depend on us seeing the video game. So hopefully they'll explain it, you know?
Yeah, I hope so too, because I'm very curious.
Yeah.
So we know Zion is okay. Everybody's relatively happy, except for obviously all the dead bodies. That's not great, but they'll figure it out. And all the machine parts they have to clean up too. It's going to be a long cleanup. But the Oracle's all good. The Oracle is back, and she meets up with the architect in the Matrix.
Yeah.
And they go ahead.
If you ever come to Sydney, I can take you to where that is, because it's a very iconic spot in the Botanic Gardens, and there's signs on the walls talking about how don't worry if you see eels squiggling across the grass in certain times of year. That's a seawall, and apparently the eels move from the sea to freshwater ponds within the park. And they literally like climb across the wall and squiggle across the, apparently like eels, they travel across land between fresh and salt water. And so in real life, that wall is covered in signs about like, don't worry about the eels, basically.
No,
I don't want to see the eel wall. Like, that's it. Like, The train station where they're fighting, not the white one, but the one where it's like a normal train station, that's also a train station in the city, one of the historic ones that's still got trains through it, but like one of the old preserved ones. So those are the two big Sydney locations I noticed, but we were like, Eel Wall, we were watching it. So yeah, it's near the Opera House, so you will see it, but hopefully not see any eels.
I want to see the eels. No, show me the eels.
Natalie and I had one seawall experience and it was perfect. And I'm not going to taint it with an eel wall.
Sorry to distract from the very important scene between the architect and the oracle, but I had to tell you about the eel wall.
Okay. I don't think there were any eels in the movie, which is a travesty at this point now that I know there could have been eels, but I guess we'll just live with it. So the oracle and the architect meet up and it's sort of this tense back and forth between the two of them where the architect is like, you know, this peace won't last. And the oracle's like, well, we're going to see how long it will. And what does she make him promise? Oh, that all of the people.
Anyone who wants to leave will be freed. So anyone who becomes conscious of the matrix, I guess. I was also like, do you mean people or do you mean programs? I was like, that's the thing. I was like, do you mean human flesh people or do you mean program people?
I hope she meant both.
Yeah. So for me, what I thought happened was like, we're not going to tamp down anyone who feels like this is wrong. We be like, yep, we need them. Like, this is the system. The system is these people are our batteries. We have our world. But they're in here. They're safe. They're happy. Like, we actually take pretty good care of them in the pods. Like, they're fine. They are actually living in a virtual reality that is like, has better living conditions than the real world. And they are real. They are people. They're living their real lives. Like, you know, but if they become conscious that there isn't a level of unreality to them, they can leave. We will not tamp them down and fight them leaving. I guess that's fine because, like, if I was in the Matrix and the real world in Zion didn't have any pizza, but the Matrix has pizza and, like, new movies and stuff.
This is not where I thought you were
going. Doesn't have anything like that. I think I would be okay, like, being conscious that I was, like, locked into a virtual reality. Like, I think I would be okay with it because I would be able to be real. Like, I know that, like, it's still my mind. So, like, you know, I want to eat the pizza and not the shitty food in Zion, you know?
I do also love pizza.
So it's kind of an interesting, like, how I think that raises the question again of, like, how fake is the Matrix? Is it 100% ethically bad?
Mm-hmm.
It's ethically bad that humanity was oppressed to the point that this happened, but we're well past that, you know? Like, so now that we've got it, like, what's the best option?
So you would trade your life juice for pizza?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So now, like, I want to know.
And able to be clean and, like, normal. And, like, I knew I would be like, okay, that's fine. Like, I'm just, like, here in the Matrix where stuff is better than the real world.
So, and Brittany and Kendra, what would you trade your life juice for? Or would you rather live in the real world?
There's no Broadway shows in Zion.
Yeah. No, that's up there. Yeah, I can't give up the comforts of my life.
Think of the dance parties in Zion, though.
I am not into that. First of all, that's a lot of
Kendra
people
is.
That I would
Kendra
need to
would
be
like
next
the Zion
to.
Dance parties.
I would go to the dance party with you.
I think that it's about being conscious of it. If I knew I was in it and I chose it and I didn't forget, like, I was like, yeah, the real world sucks, but I get to sleep in my pod and in the Matrix world, my mind is still real and I still get to, like, go on do lots of cool things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, if they let me pack a Zion sweater and live in the Matrix, I'd be fine.
I guess it kind of comes down to, because if you still live a full life in the Matrix.
Yeah.
It's not anything different than what we're experiencing
right
now.
I do not think it's as ethically bad as the movies make it out to be. Yeah. I think the fact that people don't know that it's, like, a result of, like, 700 years of, like, slavery and oppression,
mm-hmm.
I think that's bad.
The one thing having a family. Like, you can't procreate in the Matrix.
That's a good question. Of like how they procreate new people in the robot world. Is it like, because it's not like if two people fell in love or whatever, or didn't fall in love. Anyway, if they had sex and the woman got pregnant, it's not like her real human body would be pregnant. Is it like, do they follow that man and they go and like, they're like, oh, that's the person who she's with. We're going to go and like do a prostate massage and extract some sperm and we're going to impregnate that woman in her pod. We've got a new baby that's really their baby. Like, how does that.
Right. So the real world baby matches up with the Matrix baby.
Yeah. Sorry.
I don't know if we're meant to ask these questions.
Well, I think
that's why people listen to us.
I think that the next movie should deal with this, because the next movie, I don't know if you guys are aware of or not, does start like with Thomas Anderson, like adult 50-year-old man living in San Francisco in the Matrix, like going to a psychologist, and he you know, he keeps taking blue pills, like he that's his prescription. Like, it's lives a seemingly ordinary life, and his therapist prescribes blue pills. Neither him or Trinity recognize each other. However, Morpheus offers him the red pill and reopens his mind to the world of the Matrix. So that's the premise of the fourth movie. So maybe they're going to like delve a bit about fate versus real, but yes, the entire concept that all of these people are hooked into the Matrix, that's like objectively bad. I'm not going to say that it's not. However, I've never thought, even from day one of the Matrix movies, that the whole nothing I did there was real was valid. I'm like, yes, it was, because it was still you and your consciousness. It was still real, and you were interacting with other people who were presumably also real and experiencing real feelings. So I've never bought the whole it's all fake as much as Neo did. So we'll see.
Yeah. I think I do love pizza, but I'm also a dumb Gryffindor and the machines are the bad guys, and I don't want the bad guys to drink my life juice. So
I mean, why not? What are they doing that's so bad? Are you going to be able to free every human and start a new society where
I'm
going to
try?
Pizza?
Like, I will invent pizza.
Okay.
Somehow. Okay. I think that this is
yeah. I think
it's a bit too far. No, just kidding. But I think this is a really good transition between the end of the movie and talking about the fourth movie. So basically, at the end of this movie, it actually really does set up for something to continue on, because we have the questions of whether or not the peace will last. We have questions about who will end up leaving the Matrix and all of that kind of stuff. And we get Seraph comes back, Sati comes back. She affects the sunrise, which, do we know what that means? She's a program without a purpose, but she is capable of affecting the Matrix.
She's probably a big deal because she's a big character as an adult in the fourth movie.
I read an interesting theory that made me believe that the Oracle was on the same side as Neo the whole time, in that like her setting up Neo and Trinity to fall in love was setting up Neo to make a different choice. So she like was making the machine society grow past like the homeostasis they had reached with like the one continually choosing to reset the Matrix. And Sati now is a different manifestation of love from the machines. So now she's someone that the machines are like learning from.
Like she can prove to them that we have personhood too. And you know,
yeah,
that kind
so
of thing.
So she is someone that like has a lot of control over the Matrix and like that they're observing to kind of move forward. I don't know how true that is, but I thought it was interesting.
That is interesting.
I saw another theory that Trinity was a program the whole time. So we're going to have to wait and see on that one. Like that she was a program for Neo to fall in love with. Like that was her purpose, basically, to fall in love with Neo and direct him that way. But I don't know if I think that's true. Sati, however, I do think that's very valid.
I liked at the end of this movie that I think it was Sati asks the Oracle, will we ever see Neo again? And she's like, I think we will. And the ending of this movie hits way different with Resurrections on the Horizon. Like, I think back then, I don't really remember like this part of the ending precisely, probably because I was still mad about Neo and Trinity, but it was sort of like, okay, these movies are done. We're not going to get anything else. Maybe one day, but that one day is a very long time away if we ever get it. But now it's like, it's almost here. It's less than a month away. So the ending is just, it felt like a prophecy, and the prophecy is being fulfilled with Resurrections. And I really liked it.
Yeah, no, I see that. I do. And I think that there's like a lot of, you know, I think obviously they would have had to go off the back of the movie. They're not just going to like throw it all out. They're going to have to go off the back of it. But I do think that like when the movie 3 was made, they definitely didn't have a plan for more. They were kind of just like, they left it open because let people think and, you know, let people take it where they want. But they definitely were like quite anti actually continuing for a long time until a few years ago. So I think that the theme of love and will be like a big deal in the fourth movie. I do think that Sati is massively relevant in terms of that transition for like the machines to be like not evil, like to just like, hey, we've got to like make this, now that we're in this position, we've got to make this all work in a compassionate way. And so that will probably be like a big part of it. Yeah, the fourth movie is directed by Lana Wachowski, and apparently she started thinking about it due to the death of her parents. So in something like 2019 or something like that, her mother and father both died within a few months of each other, as well as another close friend. And apparently she was like so lost in that situation that for some reason she started thinking about Neo and Trinity all the time, and basically like she couldn't have her parents back. But she said, you know, I couldn't have my mum and dad, yet suddenly I had Neo and Trinity, arguably the two most important characters in my life. It was immediately comforting to have these two characters alive again, and it's super simple. You can look at it and say, okay, these two people die, and okay, bring these two people back to life, and oh, doesn't that feel good? Yeah, it did. It's simple. And this is what art does, and this is what stories do. They comfort us and they're important. So basically this movie exists because 20 years later, Lana Wachowski was like, I want them back. I want everyone back, and I can't have them back, but I can have them back. And that's what happened. So I
kind of love that.
It's probably going to be really intense and personal. So yeah, I also really, really love that. And the Wachowskis in general, I really love that most of their stuff is very self-indulgent. Like nearly every film they've made has been like complete self-fulfilling gratification without a lot of consciousness for like whether other people like it or not. Jupiter Ascending is a great example, which I think is a great movie, but it's complete wish fulfillment privately for the Wachowskis. And I feel like this is going to be that in the most like special way, basically. But I'm curious to see like what they actually do to make the science of it track or the mythology of it track, you know, when we look at how everyone gets to be alive again or conscious of the Matrix again, or like what the state of the Matrix actually is, you know?
Yeah.
Anyone got any theories about it aside from the grief theme or the love theme?
I'm so invested in what the hell Jonathan Groff is doing in this movie. I am so here for it.
Whatever it is.
So the only things we know is that he fights Neo, and in one scene at least, according to an interview with Entertainment Weekly, and that he's in a suit. So
those are both good.
Both good.
Great details.
So yeah, Priyanka Chopra is in the movie. She is apparently the adult Sati. So that's going to be interesting. And then we've got the Merovingian's going to be in the movie. So he's still there. There's a new Morpheus, a young guy who is still the embodiment of Morpheus. And then there's, yeah, Niobe, Jada Pinkett Smith. She's in the movie. And apparently there's a few other people like who might have cameos from the original series. And then Rex the three. And then Max Rimmel, who we know from Sense8, who was Wolfgang on Sense8, he's in the movie as well. So he must be like a favorite friend of the Wachowskis to have got another job here with The Matrix. Plot-wise, aside from, 20 years after the events of Revolutions, Neo is an ordinary man in San Francisco called Thomas Anderson, who's in therapy with Neil Patrick Harris, it seems like, is his therapist. So it's going to be interesting. It's going to be very interesting to see how they bring it all back together and what they end up landing on in terms of, is the Matrix inherently evil? Is it, you know, what do we do from here? How do we fix society? You know, like anything like that. What is there something you guys want to see or an answer that you want to get?
Neo and Trinity happy and in love.
Okay.
And alive.
Aside from that.
That's all I want.
I weirdly was going to say like the same thing, but I kind of feel like they could save the love story with this one. And I hope that they do. And I also just had a weird thought, like, do we know for sure that this is a one-off, that like there isn't going to be more after this, or do we not know that for sure?
I have no idea.
Okay. I wonder if they're going to do like another trilogy, the one plot, and Trinity is going to be the one this time.
How would you guys feel if this was a completely reset, like as in this isn't even the same Neo? Like it's like a Neo that was never pulled, like that the events of the three movies never happened.
I would not feel good about that.
Like X-Men-ing it?
I guess. I don't know. Like if it was a total like reboot in some way.
I wouldn't be too mad about it. I do appreciate the original trilogy. And I guess this is a good time, if I hadn't made it obvious, that I actually do really like the third movie the second time around. Like it works for me a little bit more now. So I'm okay with what happened in the first three. And I do like the idea of this being a continuation and fixing some of the things that I didn't like about the original trilogy. However, if they decide that this is Matrix 2.0 and we have a new problem to deal with, and maybe the peace is over and they have to defeat the machines once and for all or something like that, like that would be interesting too. And I think that now that it's almost 20 years later, it's going to feel like a completely new movie. We have better special effects and you can do things on screen that maybe you couldn't do before, people weren't as comfortable with before. They have a lot of room to make this more of what they wanted to make it in the beginning. And that's what I'm most looking forward to.
I'm just interested to see how it feels tonally, because like I said, like Lana, when she said about like how she did it, she was like, apparently like just like spent a night crying in grief, couldn't fall asleep, and her brain just like spewed the entire story of the movie at then. And it's like, so this is gonna like come from a very interesting place that I don't know if it was like has to go back over like, you know, the themes and make a track, or if it's just like a totally new tone, or if it's again like maybe the people will act more passionately, or like all of that. I don't know, you never know. Yeah, I don't know. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be very interesting. I don't necessarily want it to be a full reboot. Like, it's kind of more like, I guess it's kind of like the Trinity and Morph and Neo have gone back into the new Matrix, and like, you know, maybe their consciousnesses were saved and they've been inserted back into the Matrix that we see reset at the end of the third movie. I don't know. It's quite confusing, isn't it?
Yeah. Guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we jump into our favorite scenes and favorite lines now?
Yeah, sure thing.
All right. So favorite scenes, Natalie, why don't you kick us off here?
Yeah. So I mentioned in passing, I really liked the, like Niobe driving and Roland being like, I didn't know this shit could do this, but to be honest, like my favorite scene was probably that first scene in the train station with the family of programs, and Keanu looking pretty and them talking about like, oh, you've never heard a program talk about love, and love's just a word that describes, you know, this, and karma's just a word. So yeah, just that quiet scene in the train station was probably my favorite to, I mean, even though it's the start, and I guess that doesn't really mean the movie went downhill from there, but like I liked that bit.
Kendra, what about you?
My favorite scene was when Link and Z were reunited and he was never going to take the necklace off. I thought they did a really good job building up to this over the last two movies. And I like how, even though in my opinion they epically failed with the big love stories they were trying to tell, they really succeeded with this smaller one for me.
Yeah, fair enough.
Brittany?
My favorite was anytime that Keanu was acting with his eyes closed. when there was no blindfold, he just had to act with his eyes closed. I loved
it. Can you elaborate? Do you mean like once he's blinded, or do you just mean like that he closes his eyes to speak alone?
When he's blinded and not wearing like the blindfold, like when he has to like actually keep his eyes closed. That was my favorite of the whole thing.
Why?
Because I thought it was so funny.
Okay.
Like, oh, here we go. Okay.
Fair enough.
My favorite scene is when the kid switches out with Mifune and opens the door for Niobe and the rest of the crew, because like I said, I didn't really care about the kid before this, but and Mifune was kind of a jerk before this time, but he went out there willing to put his life on the line and he died a pretty horrific death. And I sobbed a lot.
Didn't like that face cut.
Yeah, that was gross. I cried a lot during the scene and not during Trinity's death or Neo's death or anything like that. And I think that just how hard they were fighting for all of this, knowing that it was probably going to end very badly, just really did something for me. And I love that the kid was, he had a lot of faith in himself. You know, he was scared and anxious and nervous about everything, but he did what he needed to do because he wanted to do it. And I thought they did a really good job kind of building him up over the two movies and letting him have this epic moment at the end where everything kind of felt very satisfying for him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, favorite lines. Why don't you go first, Nat?
Yeah, so I actually loved a lot of the random sentiments. Again, like a lot of the Oracle things sound like very profound life lessons. And again, like I love a lot of what Smith says. But the big rant at the end where Smith is going on about, the big breakdown that Smith has at the end where he's, you know, why, Mr. Anderson, why do you do it? I'm not going to recite the whole fucking speech, but he... You know, that whole thing, there was a few just amazing turns of phrases, like, you know, that, you know, love and peace are vagaries of perception, all of that kind of stuff. But at the end, he says, why, Mr. Anderson, why do you persist? And Neo says, because I choose to. And it was only when I was copying it into the doc that I realized this went really hand in hand with the first favorite line that I picked, again, like as in top of the movie. And I'm like, I can't pick one right from the start. It means everything else is downhill from there. But they go together as partners because the real favorite line was, again, the Oracle being profound. And they're talking at the beginning and she says, the real test for any choice is having to make the same choice again, knowing full well what it might cost. And that just as a statement is just like, you know, philosophically correct. You know, it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. But then I kind of wrote that down and then I looked at that speech at the end and I was like, oh, yeah, they shake hands with each other. They're meant to be like, you see that link there, like in terms of like, you know, the element of choice and the implication of choice. So, yeah, I just put those two in as a partnership, basically.
Yeah, I like those. I can see how they can go together. Kendra, what's your... objectively
everyone's best line.
Yeah. Objectively, maybe the best line in the movie. What is it?
That's what I get for doing the doc. My favorite line was when Trinity said to the Merovingian, time's up, What's it going to be, Merv?
It's so disrespectful.
It's so funny and weird. Like, it's just so, like, yeah.
I loved it. Ugh, it was great. Brittany, what are your favorite lines / noises?
So I will say I did not pay too much attention to like the dialogue to where something really, really stood out at me. So I made a joke when we were getting ready to record that my favorite line was just the, you know, 8 straight minutes of machine gun noises. It really soothed me, helped me recenter myself. But beyond that, it was probably Keanu's joke. Very good.
Yes, it was excellent.
What, the drive, you'll have to drive.
He's only told one joke in his life, Natalie. Yeah.
So it's that one. Yeah.
My favorite line is definitely not as funny, but it's between Mifune again and the kid. And the kid says, "I didn't finish the training program." And the captain, I think he was, said, "Neither did I." And then he dies. But it was just so profound for me. And like, I definitely started crying all over again when he said that.
Yeah. Like, it's kind of like, yeah, it was good.
Yeah, it was very good. Okay. Natalie, do you want to tell us about this feedback?
Oh, well, Leo's been listening to this show. And she's like, I've got, oh my God, you guys should, the last thing last month, where we're talking about, like, you know, the fugly spoon that the small child gives Leo before he leaves. And we're like, spoon. And she was like, no, it's meaningful. And like, she was like, where can I write to you people about this? And I was like, oh no, Twitter. So she tweeted saying, "My friends, the child's spoon gif is doing a symbology. It's a crappy dented handmade spoon because it's real with human errors. Unlike the shiny, sleek non-spoon of the Matrix, you know, there is no spoon. This time there is a spoon and it's meant to just be like a reminder to Neo of like the difference between, I guess, like the Matrix and reality, like that this shitty spoon is better than the fake spoon." But like, I see it, but like, apparently we were very dismissive of the spoon.
Oh. I would like to point out that I purposefully put it in the doc and spent some time looking up what it meant and had inconclusive evidence, but I did put it in the doc.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, apparently she had some feelings about that. So that was a piece of feedback from Matrix 2. Curious about if anyone has feelings for Matrix 3 or 4, like if anyone's read any big theories, because we should probably do an episode about Matrix 4 to wrap this up. Like once we see it, like maybe in January, we'll do like a little special episode about having gone to see Matrix 4, just as a sort of conclusion to this series.
Yeah. I would like that.
Yeah. Once we all see it.
Yeah. I will say, I assumed we were.
Yeah, so did I.
I did not know that we were thinking about it.
Okay. So what do you mean? You assumed we would be doing that.
We would be doing
it. Yeah.
Well, it's just like, I don't know when everyone's going to get to see it. Like it comes out on the 22nd or something. It's like, not like we're going to record it on Christmas. So like,
we'll probably have to wait till January.
In the first week of January, maybe. But yeah.
Yeah.
We'll look into it.
Cool. Well, if you guys have any feedback for us, either about something that we just did not understand or something that you agreed or disagreed with, or some theories that you have for the fourth movie, you can contact us through email at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram and Twitter at re_watchable. We also love getting iTunes reviews from you. They really, really help. And if you rate us 5 stars on iTunes, then I will make a pretty sunrise for you. Any colors you want, just let me know. And don't forget about our Facebook group, Rewatchables Rewinders. We have some fun over there, so please join. All right, well, that wraps it up. 3 movies of The Matrix down. I feel pretty satisfied. Hope you guys do too. And I guess we will definitively be seeing you for the 4th one as well, which is good to know.
I mean, I didn't know if everyone would want to, but yeah.
Yeah. All right. This is us signing off. I'm Karen.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Kendra.
And I'm Brittany.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Do you know that whenever we get to sign offs, I always feel like, wow, I'm so faking this. I don't know how anyone believes hosting a podcast. Cause I forget that we're doing a podcast when we're just talking and then we have to sign off and it's more formal. I'm like, oh my God, imposter syndrome.
How long have you been podcasting for? Like 7 years?
Yeah, like 7 years. And
maybe more.
And it's like the most traumatic 10 seconds of every time.
But that's okay, because that means it feels like you're just hanging out with your friends.
Go ahead, Brittany.
I just spoke. You can go first. I'm going to leave this banter in when I'm editing.